Welcome back to New Books in History. My name is Isabel Moore, and I'm a host on the channel. Today, my conversation is with Tamar Carroll, an assistant professor of history at Rochester Institute of Technology and program director of digital humanities and social sciences. Her book, Mobilizing New York, AIDS, Anti-Poverty, and Feminist Activism, published by University of North Carolina Press in 2015, is the topic of today's show. In the book, Carroll examines the history and legacy of three path-breaking social movements in New York City from the 1950s through the 1990s. She demonstrates the way the movements used community organizing, concepts of identity, and coalitions with other groups to further their causes. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Isabel Moore, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Tamar Carroll about her 2015 book, Mobilizing New York, AIDS, Anti-Poverty, and Feminist Activism, published by University of North Carolina Press. Tamar Carroll, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're so glad you're here. So I wonder, Tamar, if you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself, your personal and academic background, and how you became interested in the study of history.
Sure. I grew up in Andover, Massachusetts, and I always loved history in school. I went to UMass Amherst as an undergraduate, and I double majored in journalism and history. And I did some internships at newspapers and was frustrated by what I felt was an inability to go to really tell the full story or go as deeply as I wanted to in reporting on issues. I also reported for the UMass Daily Collegian. I was an investigative reporter for it's a daily newspaper at UMass. So I got a taste of journalism and decided that I would go to grad school for history because I wanted to be able to write longer pieces and also just to study things so I had a better understanding. But while I was at UMass Amherst, I took classes with Kathy Pice, who is now at the University of Pennsylvania, who's a really amazing historian of gender and sexuality. And she inspired my interest in women's history, which actually was pretty late in my career at UMass, but in time for me to pursue that in graduate school at the University of Michigan. And at Michigan, I studied with Regina Morin Sanchez, again, a fantastic scholar of women's history, gender, medical history, and Jewish history as well. And just someone who her knowledge is just so expansive. And she's a wonderful editor who really pushed me to improve my writing and to write in an accessible way. So I studied with Gina, and my co-chair for my dissertation was Matthew Lassiter, who's a historian of politics in the United States in the post-45 period. And so I was combining fields, combining, you know, the study of women, gender, and sexuality with the study of politics and social movements and the state. And so being able to draw on both of their expertise was really important in shaping the dissertation, which became my book.
So thanks so much for telling us a little bit about your background. And how did you come to write this particular book, Mobilizing New York?
I was in a required seminar on liberalism and political history with Terry McDonald, who he's another wonderful historian who influenced me a lot. So I was learning about liberal political theory, and I had to write a research paper. And I was interested in feminist activism, and part of what we had read in Terry's class was Todd Gitlin's Twilight of Common Dreams, and it sort of, you know, there's an associated body of literature that sort of feminist activism, gay rights activism, and Black power activism in particular as fragmenting the left, right? And kind of paving the way for the rise of conservatism in the 1980s. And I thought that that was wrong. And I wanted to find some examples, some counterexamples, because I really thought that the problem was when differences weren't acknowledged, right? And so that was what led to fragmentation. And so I went to Smith, and all of that was kind of in my mind. But what I thought I was going to do, I got a small grant from Smith that allowed me to stay there. I think it was for like a month in the summer. And I was going to look at Gloria Steinem's papers. And an archivist there was like, hey, you know, if you're interested in feminism, we just got this new collection on working class feminists from Brooklyn. And I was like, what? You know, because first of all, I hadn't really read anything about working class feminists. And so I was really intrigued. And I read, I started going through their material, and I read, you know, their original goals and objectives, which were very much about bringing people together across differences of race and class, to work, together, for women's issues, but also for community issues. So I was really intrigued. They didn't fit with the historiography that I had learned, you know, that I was learning about. And I spent, like I said, about a month in the archives that summer. And then I also went to Brooklyn, and with my grad school, my dear roommate and friend from grad school, Lara Roosh, who's a political scientist. She teaches at the University of Michigan Dearborn now. But anyway, Lara and I interviewed the founder of the National Congress of Neighborhood Women, Jan Peterson, in Brooklyn. And Jan told me more about the organization and also put me in touch with other women. So I did additional oral history interviews. And that, you know, that became a seminar paper. And then eventually I was working on my prospectus for the dissertation, and I had gotten positive feedback on the seminar paper about the National Congress for Neighborhood Women. So I knew I wanted to keep that in the dissertation, to expand it and make it better. But I also decided I wanted to look for other case studies, other examples of groups that had formed coalitions for progressive social change, that had members with different identities. And so I went back to the archives. And in this case, I went back to Smith, and I also went to Tamamint. And at Smith, the interesting thing is, they collect women's history archives, but they had Richard Cloward's archives, the radical criminologist and sociologist whose partner is Francis Fox Piven. And Francis Fox Piven donated Richard's papers to Smith, and she allowed me to look at them, even though they weren't totally open to the public yet, because he had just recently died. And at that time, anyway, so Richard Cloward helped co-found Mobilization for Youth. And Jan Peterson had told me about Mobilization for Youth because that was where she worked as a social worker when she first came to New York. And that's where she learned about organizing and where she learned a lot about social change, actually. And so, and she had told me how important Mobilization for Youth's emphasis on maximum feasible participation was, the idea that poor people should be involved in decision making about social programs that were directed at them. That became part of the larger war on poverty. And that's one of the lasting influences of Mobilization for Youth. So at Smith, I studied more about mobilization for youth, and then I also their records are also at the Columbia Social Welfare at Columbia in the School for Social Welfare. And there's oral histories related to them at Columbia. I went back to New York and I did more interviews there, although some of the people involved in mobilization for youth had died, but some of them were still alive. And so I talked to them. And I was at Tamament, which is at the library at NYU, which is a radical history archive. Labor union. And I went there to look at CARASA, specifically, which was a reproductive rights group that brought together abortion rights activists and, anti-sterilization activists. So CARASA was really important in broadening, the movement from abortion rights to reproductive rights and looking at women's right to be mothers, as well as the right to choose not to become a mother. So I was there studying CARASA, and then again, an archivist said, "Hey, you know, we have this new collection. It hasn't been cataloged yet. Would you like to see it?" And I had been there for like 6 weeks, and I was scheduled to go back to Michigan. I only had like a couple days left, and they're like, "We could bring it out from storage." So I said, yeah, I want to see it. And the first thing I saw was pictures of the Church Ladies for Choice, which were these gay men that would dress up in drag and sing songs about reproductive rights. And I was hooked. I was like, why are they doing this? I want to learn more. And so the thing is, in order to see more, I had to contact Elizabeth Meixel, who was the activist, the founder of the Church Ladies for Choice, who had donated the archives. And she made me keep meeting her at demonstrations. So I would be at 8 a.m. standing on the sidewalk at a demonstration. And after we did that a few times, I won Elizabeth's trust. And she let me interview her, and she put me in touch with other members of the Church Ladies and of Women's Health Action Mobilization, and the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, so WHAM and ACT UP. And that became the final case study of the book. And I never did work CARASA in. They're a very important organization, and maybe I'll get to write about them in the future. But there are other historians that have written about CARASA, and nobody, to my knowledge, no other historians had written about WHAM and ACT UP and the Church Ladies. So that was why I decided to make them my final case study.
Interesting. So it sounds like the archives really kind of led you on this journey of discovering different groups that were active and using kind of innovative approaches.
Yeah, very much so.
Interesting. So, so you've kind of given us a really helpful overview of the groups that you wound up using as your case studies, and you focus on basically the 1950s to 1990s in New York City, on the several activists and community organizations that you just filled us in on. Why don't we start by talking about mobilization for youth a little bit more in depth? That brings us to your first two chapters on the mobilization for youth in the Lower East Side. Could you start by telling us a little bit more about the origins of the organization, its approach, and what you found when you looked into that group?
Sure. So the origins were actually it began under the Kennedy administration as an anti-juvenile crime program, basically. And so the president's committee on juvenile delinquency gave Cloward and his partners a substantial grant to start this organization, And the idea they based it on, it was the idea of blocked opportunity, that young Latino and African-American men in particular, living on the Lower East Side of New York City, which was a poor and working class neighborhood that was undergoing residential change. So a lot of the it was a historically a Jewish neighborhood, and a lot of white residents were moving to the suburbs, and more people from Puerto Rico and more African Americans from the South and from other parts of New York City were moving in. And there were still Jewish residents and Irish residents. So it was a diverse neighborhood, but that was changing quickly. And there was a lot of heroin use and gang fights. And people were very concerned about the violence and trying to stem drug use. And so they were really focused on young men and trying to give them pathways to become successful citizens. So it involved things like job training. So that was the initial plan, and it was funded by the Kennedy administration. But what they found when they started opening up offices with social workers is that it really wasn't the male teenage youth that was interested in their help. It was mothers, you know, poor mothers that were coming in because they couldn't get welfare benefits, or in their apartment there was no heat and the landlord wouldn't fix it, or there was no running water, or there were rats that were biting their children, right, and spreading disease. So housing conditions were really bad. And that was something that the mothers were really bringing to the attention of the social workers, as well as the arbitrary nature of the welfare administration's decision making, and just the fact that people were really struggling to provide for their families. And so those experiences really radicalized the social workers and the administrators at Mobilization for Youth. And they started working with residents. And so it grew into the welfare rights movement and also the legal services movement. So they hired lawyers and began suing the city. So lawyers were working with these women and their families and filing class action lawsuits, and having a lot of success, really. So they pioneered welfare law. And so from this one organization came broad changes, really, in terms of how people thought about poor people and what they could achieve and how they should be treated.
Great. And you also talk about how Mobilization for Youth kind of catalyzed other organizations and initiatives. Can you talk a little bit about the role that Mobilization for Youth played in the mid to late 1960s in New York?
Well, sure. I mean, I think so it's important to say that that Mobilization for Youth was red-baited. So the thing is, not everyone liked the fact that this organization that was federally funded and also funded by the city and state of New York and the Ford Foundation, that they were turning around and, for example, boycotting landlords that, you know, refused to make improvements in their building and suing landlords and suing the city. So some, for example, state legislators got very angry and they accuse Mobilization for Youth of being being infiltrated by communists, being a red organization. And, you know, in fact, there were former members of the Communist Party on the staff, which is not surprising given that New York City had the largest population of communists. It wasn't illegal, right, to be a member of the Communist Party prior to World War II. And these were left-leaning radical social workers. They were not, like, disloyal, and they were not, you know, aiding the Soviet Union at all. So those claims were false. But nonetheless, it led to the organization being defunded by the late 60s. However, the people that trained at Mobilization for Youth spread out across New York City, really and across the nation, and they started other organizations, and they used their ties, they networked in order to get War on Poverty funding for the other organizations. So even though Mobilization for Youth, except for the Legal Services Division, which still continues to operate and is very important, even though the rest of Mobilization for Youth was basically withered away within a few years in the early 70s, the influence of Mobilization for Youth persisted both in New York and across the country through the War on Poverty legislation, which adopted many of the ideas that Mobilization for Youth piloted, and then through the people that were trained at Mobilization for Youth. And a lot of them actually went on to become faculty members at schools of social work and train other students too. So there's also that, you know, transfer of knowledge across generations that happened that way.
Terrific. And is there anything else that we should know about Mobilization for Youth and about the 1960s before we look at the National Congress of Neighborhood Women?
Well, I guess I should have, one thing I should have said is that the other thing that was so important was that the civil rights movement was happening in the 1960s. And that inspired both the residents of the Lower East Side and the social workers. So, for example, they took several trains to the March on Washington. And when they came back from that, the residents of the Lower East Side were much more emboldened, for example, to protest a school superintendent that was being very condescending primarily to a group of mothers that were Puerto Rican, and, you know, saying things to them like, well, you won't understand me anyway because you only understand Spanish, and, you know, blaming the mothers for their children not learning when they were saying, hey, our children aren't being given books. They don't have homework. You know, what's going on? And the mothers were trying to become more involved in the schools, and the schools were not open to that. And so this group, Mobilization for Mothers, you know, they reflect the broader change that took place, and that also spread to other groups across New York City, because people in general were inspired by Martin Luther King Jr. and by CORE, but, you know, by the student protests, by everything that was happening across the nation in terms of the civil rights movement. And so that was radicalizing, as well as their experiences with the city bureaucracies and with landlords.
Great. Thank you for that. So you then turn to across the way in Brooklyn in the late 1960s and early 1970s to Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Can you tell us a little bit about the neighborhood organizing happening there and the National Congress of Neighborhood Women?
Yeah. So Jan Peterson, when she left Mobilization for Youth, She went to Williamsburg, and it was a very different neighborhood than it is now. Now it is very gentrified, but at that time it was very much a working class, largely Italian American neighborhood, also some Polish residents, a large Orthodox Jewish population. This was North Williamsburg, so on the border with Greenpoint. And it was, you know, people worked at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which then was closed by Robert McNamara. So there was a lot of loss of industrial jobs. It was, you know, historically, it was a waterfront, industrial and manufacturing and area. And a lot of those jobs were going away. And so men were losing their jobs, and women who had traditionally not worked outside the home in that neighborhood were needing to, in order to make up for their husband's lost income or because their husband's pay wasn't enough anymore. So these were women. So Jan started working, and Jan was very interesting because she was part of the civil rights movement. She was part of Harlem Core while she was a social worker at Mobilization for Youth, but she was also part of New York radical feminists. So she was going to women's consciousness raising groups. And she was also interested in white ethnics and class. So she was connected to all these diverse social movements because she's so passionate about social change and social justice. And she was willing to take ideas and borrow from them all. And so she started working with a group of Italian American women, and they hadn't had the opportunity to go to college. Most of them hadn't graduated high school even, because the attitude was, why do you need an education? You're just going to stay home and be a mom. And so they just they hadn't had those opportunities. And Jan basically was doing, you know, some consciousness raising with them and trying to work to empower them through education. So like the first thing she did with her War on Poverty grant was help them learn to drive, because none of them had driver's licenses. And then she took them to Washington, D.C. With money from the Center for Urban Ethnic Affairs. So that was part of the progressive strain of the white ethnic movement that was trying to combat the deterioration of working class neighborhoods in the nation's big cities, and try to help people work together to restore communities. And so they met up with feminist nuns there, and actually women traveled from across the country to come to this first meeting of working class feminists. And so that is an amazing, there's footage of that consciousness raising session, film footage, which is available. You can stream it from the Sophia Smith archives at Smith College. And it's really powerful testimony, women talking about the challenges they face in their lives because they're women. And they also talk, it's a diverse group of women, so they talk about their racial and ethnic backgrounds and the challenges that those have brought in their lives, as well as what it means to be poor or working class. So that group, when Jan brought them back to Brooklyn, that's when they founded the National Congress of Neighborhood Women. And it was always based in Brooklyn, but they had chapters throughout the country. And I didn't study the other chapters. I only focus really on the New York chapters. But there are materials at Smith about the other chapters, and that would be a great research project for someone to pick up on. But so anyway, one of the first things that they did was create a college program in Williamsburg that was aimed at women, although they did admit men as well, but it was mostly women. And that was who it was aimed at. Women that, you know, hadn't had a chance to go to college. It was tuition free and the classes were taught in the neighborhood, to make it accessible. And, that was a really wonderful thing. They taught the students participated in designing the curriculum and choosing the faculty, many of whom were leading feminist scholars from, across New York City who were interested in what Jan was doing. And so they taught, classes in women's health and women's studies and in history of family and history of immigration and in urban sociology and community organizing. So the students were getting this really cutting edge curriculum. And that was one of the ways that they learned to come together in the neighborhood, which had been very divided between the working class white ethnic population. And then there was a large, public housing project in the neighborhood as well, that was primarily African American and Latinas, and there had been a long history of racial violence from the white working class residents against the people of color in the public housing project. And the women leadership of the tenants association there wanted to be part of the National Congress of Neighborhood Women so that they could access the college program and then the jobs program that they were able to start with CETA funding, Comprehensive Employment Training Act funding. They put hundreds of women in jobs at feminist nonprofits across New York. So they really funded the whole women's movement. They were able to staff it by winning these grants that Jan was really good at getting because she had so many contacts from her participation in all these diverse networks.
Terrific. And what you talk some about kind of the significance of knowing that this was going on in the 1970s. What do you see as the significance of this organizing through the National Congress of Neighborhood Women for understanding women's activism in the 70s?
Well, I think it's important because there's been a critique of feminism that says that it was only, you know, an upper middle class white thing. And that is just historically inaccurate. And looking at the National Congress for Neighborhood Women shows how broad and how diverse a group of women, you know, supported feminism and were involved in it. And actually, the NCNW established the first publicly funded battered women's shelter in New York City, working together with the YWCA. They created the Women's Survival Space. And that was important to women that were that had nowhere else to go, that were trying to flee situations of domestic violence. And those women came from all different backgrounds. Yeah, their domestic violence affects, you know, upper middle class white women, but it also affects poor women, African American women, Latina women. And so those women fought to establish the shelter. And that grew out of consciousness raising that was associated with their college curriculum and with taking classes and then meeting together as a group because they had support groups to help the women get through and earn their associate's degree. And they started talking and sharing about the violence they were facing. And then they decided to take action and establish a shelter. And then some of them were the first staff at the shelter. So I think it's important to look at what was actually happening in the women's movement. And because that's a legacy for all women today, not just women, but really for all of us to see that some of the most important gains that were achieved by second wave feminism were not made only, you know, by educated white women, but that they were made by really diverse groups of women working together for common goals.
Great. And you also kind of examine how different women coming together wasn't without conflict. They had to deal with issues of race. There were internal conflicts about leadership and efforts to build partnerships across lines of difference with other organizations and initiatives. Can you talk a little bit about how they dealt with those issues and kind of figured out how to deal with them?
Yeah, so they and this took time, but over time they developed a form of structured consciousness raising in their leadership support training program, and actually they've made it available online, so you can still go to their website. The National Congress for Neighborhood Women, which is it's part of a international group now called Groots International, and you can read the details of it. But basically, they had two kinds of small group support groups, and in one they were allies panels, and one were what we could call identity panels or groups. So, for example, Black women would meet in a group with each other in the identity group panel. And then in the allies panel, Black and white and Latina women would all meet together, right? And the same thing for class. So the professional women, because there were a lot of educated, you know, lawyers and professors and other professional women that helped the group and that were necessary for them to get grants and administer the grants and, you know, that had vision that could really help the women achieve their goals. And they couldn't have achieved what they did without the professional women, but they also didn't want the professional women to dominate the group and you know, oppress the working class women in it, right? They didn't, that was the whole point, was to empower the working class women and to help white ethnic women and African American women form a coalition and Latina women and function together. So the professional women would meet in their own group as an identity group and then also be in an allies panel. And in the allies panel, you know, the women would listen to each other and gain a better understanding of what each person's experiences and issues were. And that was really, both of those groups were necessary because women needed to have what we might call today a safe space where they were around women that had similar experiences to them. And then they needed to be challenged in the allies panel to gain greater knowledge and empathy of women whose experiences were different from them. And that over time, that was a lengthy process, but it led many of the women in the group who you know, did come from different racial and ethnic backgrounds to form really strong friendships. Some of them moved in together, lived together. You know, they helped raise each other's children. So they got past their initial fear and racism, you know, which had been ingrained in many of the white ethnic women.
Interesting. So what would you say that this kind of method that they figured out for building that kind of solidarity spread to other places? Was that part of the legacy of the organization, or are there other legacies that we should know about?
I do think that so they ran leadership training institutes and community organizers from all over the country came to those. So yes, they have trained others, although actually I think that this is a methodology that would be really relevant to, for example, the organizers of the Women's March this past weekend in Washington, D.C. If you were following the news coverage of it, there was a lot of discussion of identity politics and whether white women would recognize the need to take action, for example, on issues like police brutality, which affects primarily communities of color. And so I think that those discussions, I think, you know, if that is going to, if the Women's March is going to translate into a successful social movement, that adopting that kind of methodology that the NCNW used to help diverse groups of women identify mutual needs and become better allies, to understand how to support each other without talking over each other, without professional women just imposing their ideas on less educated women. I think that would be really important for organizers going forward.
Interesting point. And it seems like, you know, so much of what you talk about in this book is really relevant for our current political moment. And in particular, why don't we turn now to your discussion of the 1980s and 1990s and ACT UP and WAM, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. And can you fill us in on WAM? I realize I'm forgetting the acronym right now.
No problem. Yeah. Women's Health Action and Mobilization, WAM.
Yeah. Great. So yeah, so you talk about ACT UP and WAM, the Church Ladies for Choice, and the ways that these groups worked together in the 80s and 90s. Could you tell us more about those groups and what you found when you looked into that time period?
Sure. Well, so first of all, I should say that the 80s and 90s were really different because the federal government discontinued maximum feasible participation, and they discontinued the funding that had made Mobilization for Youth and the National Congress of Neighborhood Women possible. So the NCNW continued, but they needed to find private funding, foundation funding, and there were a lot of rules attached to it, and it was much less oriented towards involving poor residents in decision making, and more about providing services, and it weakened. I think it's fair to say that it weakened, and it led the organization to turn towards the international women's movement, and they lost some of the programs that they had built in New York City, including the college program, which was a real loss and is really sad. So the 80s, when the Reagan administration came in and implemented massive budget cuts to social welfare programs, that represented a really different opportunity structure, we could say. And so instead of social movements working with the state and relying on the state, instead we see social movements opposed to the state. And that kind of oppositional stance and not taking any federal funding were both really important to the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, to ACT UP New York, and to WAM, Women's Health Action Mobilization. So basically, ACT UP was founded by a group of mostly gay men, although feminists and people, it was, you know, a lot of white gay men in New York City that formed ACT UP, but both people of color and feminist women, lesbians and straight feminist women, were really important to the group. And I can talk more about that in a moment. But basically, New York City was ground zero for the AIDS epidemic. It had, you know, very high death rates. And the city was not mounting an adequate response. The city hospitals were overwhelmed. There wasn't enough service provision. And gay men were saying, what, our community is being decimated, you know, and we need to do something. And they were frustrated both at the local government and by the Reagan administration as well, because Reagan hadn't said the word AIDS. He hadn't acknowledged that this epidemic was happening, and they felt that he should be prioritizing it and making sure that there was federal funding available for research, for treatment, that they should be speeding up, because there really was no effective treatment at this point for AIDS. And people were dying very young and in a lot of pain. And it was really, people felt really desperate. And so the playwright Larry Kramer gave a impassioned talk. And he said, you know, if we don't do something, we're all going to die. And, you know, this is it. And so they formed it as a direct action group so that they could do things like civil disobedience in order to draw media attention to the issue of AIDS and to put pressure on decision makers, people in leadership positions, both in private industry, for example, at pharmaceutical companies, at the FDA, you know, in City Hall, in Congress, in the White House. So they didn't want to provide services because they didn't want to take federal funding, because they wanted to be able to break the law by committing civil disobedience, and to really, you know, be as outrageous in their opposition as possible in order to get the most attention. So, you know, it was very strategic. When I say outrageous, I don't mean they were being outrageous just to be outrageous. But for example, they shut down trading on Wall Street and disrupted trading in order to draw attention to price gouging when the first AIDS drugs did come out. And they would, you know, shut down Grand Central Station in New York and disrupt commute in order to draw attention to AIDS. So they were really committed to using dramatic street theater and to using really good graphics. They also wheat pasted posters. You know, their most famous one is Silence Equals Death, which the art collective Grand Fury designed. They were part of ACT UP, and activists would paste thousands of those posters around New York City in a weekend, again, to draw people's attention to AIDS and to call for funding and for changing policies to get better treatment. So I guess the other thing I should say, and this brings in WHAM, is that locally, Cardinal John O'Connor, who is a very conservative and outspoken cardinal, he really was the Vatican's representative in the U.S. at this time. He spoke for the Vatican. He was very influential nationally, internationally, and he controlled a lot in New York City, in part because the church was providing a lot of health care. They then and now continue to run a lot of health care facilities. And the thing is, they wouldn't allow for discussion of condoms or safer sex practices. And so and they also didn't allow for discussion of abortion or birth control. So not even administering those things, but, you know, allowing for discussion of them. And they were blocking safer sex curriculum from the public schools and saying a lot of homophobic things. Cardinal O'Connor and other members of the church hierarchy in New York City were publicly making homophobic statements about AIDS that was really inciting violence against gay men. And they also made very public proclamations against abortion providers, and they were encouraging of groups like Operation Rescue, which were very radical in the 80s and 90s in terms of anti-abortion activists chaining themselves to the doors of women's health clinics and preventing women from getting inside. So basically, feminist reproductive rights activists and gay men AIDS activists were brought together to combat the church and the public funding that the church was getting. The city of New York funded them to open the first comprehensive AIDS care clinic. And they said, this is wrong. Why should this organization that is being led by, you know, openly homophobic leaders, men, why should they be receiving public funding to run an AIDS clinic? Like, it just doesn't make sense. And so many of ACT UP and WHAM's joint actions were directed at Cardinal O'Connor and the hierarchy of the Catholic Church in New York City to say they shouldn't be receiving public funding. And if they do, then they need to change their policies because they're having real consequences when people can't get information about or access to birth control and safer sex, for example.
Wonderful. And you kind of, in the course of talking about their dramatic actions and the coalitions that they were forming, there's sort of an interesting parallel with the National Congress of Neighborhood Women in terms of the internal dynamics. So can you tell us a little bit about the Majority Action Committee and the Women's Caucus within ACT UP and how those interacted with the kind of actions that you've been telling us about?
Yeah, so one of the things about ACT UP that was important was that it was a very large group, like thousands of people came to ACT UP's weekly meetings, and you know, some of their largest demonstrations had in New York had like 5,000 participants. So it was a much larger group than the NCNW, for example. But they had affinity groups, which were small groups of people that were trained in civil disobedience to support each other, and that would generate ideas. And it wasn't just civil disobedience. They had groups that were doing research on drug treatments, for example, or research on how to change the CDC's definition of AIDS so that it included opportunistic infections that women and poor people were getting that gay men were not getting. Because the CDC hadn't recognized that. And that meant that women with AIDS, for example, didn't qualify for disability insurance. And that was so that was something that the ACT UP Women's Caucus worked on. So ACT UP had many smaller groups within it, including the Women's Caucus and the Majority Action Committee, which was made up of people of color, who were the majority of people with AIDS then and now in this country and worldwide as well. And so they were trying to support each other and to draw attention to the racial, and because race and class align so closely in this country, you know, to the class issues that people of color were struggling with, compounding the epidemic. So they were really looking at the social context of the epidemic, not just the science, right? But the fact that, for example, homeless people with AIDS were dying really young because they were getting so many opportunistic infections. They didn't have access to regular healthcare. And New York City had a huge homeless population, which was only recently surpassed, I'm sad to say, in 2016. But 1989 was the you know, peak of New York's homeless population, and tens of thousands of people were homeless and sleeping on the streets. And many of them had HIV or AIDS. And so the Majority Action Committee staged a lot of demonstrations, including ones at Trump Tower, drawing attention to the fact that the city was giving all these tax breaks to developers like Trump to build luxury housing, and yet they weren't doing anything. And in fact, they were tearing down SROs, single residency occupancy. So these basically housing for poor people was being torn down and replaced with luxury housing with funding from the city of New York to private real estate developers. So the Majority Action Committee was trying to make people aware of what was happening and to get the city to allocate funding for to build shelter for homeless people with AIDS, to build appropriate long-term housing. And they actually wound up spinning off and creating a nonprofit called Housing Works, which is still in operation in New York City today, and which has built housing. And they decided that they had to become service providers, that the need was so great that they couldn't only be an oppositional group. And so there was tension within ACT UP over that, because not everybody in ACT UP, you know, wanted to go that route. But they split off amicably and said, listen, we identify with the community of people of color who have AIDS, and their needs are too great for us to not become involved in service provision.
Interesting. And so I think with all of those threads that you talk about, there's so many sort of ripples from activism in the 80s and 90s. And we haven't talked in detail about Church Ladies for Choice, but can you kind of fold them in and telling us about legacies of ACT UP, WHAM, Church Ladies for Choice, the activism of the 80s and 90s? What were some of those ripple effects?
Yeah, so the Church Ladies for Choice, they were part of, the members of Church Ladies for Choice were part of ACT UP, and their founder, Elizabeth Meixel, founded WHAM, Women's Health Action Mobilization. She was a co-founder, and WHAM was founded in response to the Webster Supreme Court decision, and really to a string of restrictions being placed on women's right to abortion and access to abortion, as well as the resurgence in anti-abortion activism by groups like Operation Rescue. So WHAM was responding both to the Supreme Court allowing greater restrictions, things like waiting periods, states making it mandatory, for example, that women look at ultrasounds, or, you know, there's a whole bunch of restrictions that have been placed. And the Supreme Court was, under Casey, largely upholding those restrictions. So they were mobilizing against that on the one hand, and then also, though, and importantly, they wanted to help women get into women's health clinics. So they organized escort services so that when Operation Rescue or the other groups, many of which, for example, were led by Catholic priests, and they would come and do pray in front of abortion clinics and not physically obstruct women the same way that Operation Rescue would, but, nonetheless, it was intimidating to patients who are trying to get in to have a large group of people on the sidewalk in front of the clinic. This is also when, you know, there were several abortion doctors killed and abortion clinics were being firebombed. Until the Clinton administration came in and Janet Reno stationed federal marshals at abortion clinics and stopped the violence, at least for a period of time, she was successful in stopping it. So WAM members were trying to keep clinics open and try to help women feel safe and get in. Because if your blood pressure goes up too high, you can't have a medical procedure, whether it's an abortion or, you know, any of the many other women's health services that Planned Parenthood, for example, provides. And so so this was like, these were really tense standoffs between, you know, reproductive rights activists and anti-abortion activists. It was pretty unpleasant. The anti-abortion activists would like hold up signs with bloody fetuses on them and they would shout baby killer and try to shame the women that were going in. And so Elizabeth had this great idea and she was inspired by others, but she decided, why don't we form the Church Ladies for Choice and use satire as a means of responding to this very tense situation outside women's health clinics. And so she brought her old bridesmaids dresses to her gay male friends from ACT UP, and they loved the idea, and so the Church Ladies for Choice were born, and they would dress up in drag and sing songs about reproductive rights. So, for example, they rewrote Woody Guthrie's famous, you know, most famous song, "This Land Is Our Land." They would rewrite it to "This Womb Is My Womb," etc. And they put together a Church Ladies songbook, and they would sing, you know, outside clinics, and that really helped boost the spirits of the women that were volunteering to escort patients in. It boosted the spirits of patients. It made them laugh, and it helped diffuse the tension and make them feel safer and make them feel affirmed. And that was really important, you know, on a personal level. And then they would also, you know, participate in marches and have fundraisers. And so, so the Church Ladies for Choice, they're still performing, even though they're getting older, and their founder had to move outside of New York City recently. But she is continuing to organize in her retirement community in Arizona. So, you know, I think maybe that's one of the legacies, to answer the other part of your question, is that people that participated in these social movements, even when that movement went into abeyance, as historians like to say, when that movement ends, because pretty much all social movements ebb and flow, right? So it's normal for them to end, but they have moved on to be actively engaged in other fights for social justice in New York City and in many communities across the nation. And I'm in touch with some of them that I've interviewed over email. And, you know, many of them, for example, are mobilizing today, again, in response to some of the policies that the Trump administration has announced it will be implementing around immigration, around reproductive rights, in particular, those issues.
Great. And I think that's a great transition. Before we talk about your current exhibit that examines some of these issues, what do you see as the significance of your book for this political moment? What can we learn, or what frameworks does the research that you did kind of ask us to use to understand what's happening now?
So that's a really good question and a hard question. You know, I guess at its broadest level, at the most, you know, general, I would say that people really can make a difference, and that, you know, that so they can achieve social change and social justice by working together in coalitions, and that they will, that will make a great deal of difference in their own lives. So I would encourage people to form communities, you know, like that, having those diverse interactions and friendships is really sustaining, and that that people will make more effective movements for social change if they incorporate diverse perspectives. And that can only happen from building face-to-face relationships with people that are different than you. And that is really important. And that means sometimes you don't agree on everything, and that's okay. In my opinion, it's not a good idea to have a litmus test. You know, you can choose which issues you do agree on and work together to change those. And I think that is going to be really important for activists moving forward to do that, to figure out where do we agree, how can we support each other, and to focus on that.
Great. And I think your book, just looking at the ways these groups fed into each other, influence each other, the mechanisms that they use to achieve what they achieved, is highly connect. We can learn a lot from looking at those movements of the past. And you've actually given us another opportunity to learn about movements and activism of the past in your current exhibit that is up. Can you tell us a little bit about the exhibit and how it relates to your book?
Yeah, I'd love to. So when I was finishing the book in 2014, I contacted Meg Handler, who's a wonderful photographer and a photo editor, because I wanted to include some photographs she had taken of ACT UP demonstrations, and specifically the ashes action, where people brought the ashes of their loved ones that had died of AIDS to Washington, D.C., and threw them on the lawn of the White House. And the photographs are incredibly powerful. And so I wrote to Meg to ask her if I could license them to include in my book. And she said yes. And she put me in touch with other photographers, because she was editor of the Village Voice in the 90s, and she knew a lot of photographers that were progressive, that were, you know, that were working in the social documentary tradition of using their photographs to show the need for social change. So I explained the book to her, and so she put me in touch with other photographers so I could include some of their work in my book. But we also just struck up a correspondence, and she said, you know, Tamar, this would make a great exhibit. And she knew Michael Camber, who is the founder of the Bronx Documentary Center. And that is a gallery that is in the South Bronx. It's dedicated to the social documentary tradition, and it's dedicated to educating and empowering residents of the South Bronx. So I thought, great, you know. And so Meg and I pitched our idea to Mike. We loved the idea that, you know, kids from the South Bronx would come on school field trips and see the exhibit, that it would have a much more diverse audience there than it would if we tried to put it in an, a gallery in downtown Manhattan, a commercial gallery or something. So Mike really liked the idea, but he encouraged us to broaden beyond the framework I had used in my book of progressive movements for social change. And so we looked instead, we collected the work of 38 photojournalists who were working in New York City in the 80s and 90s. And we just looked at everything they sent us related to activism, to demonstrations, but also to riots, to moments of spontaneous violence, like the Crown Heights race riots. So it was really a challenge for me as a historian. I got to learn a lot more actually about New York City in the 80s and 90s. One of the saddest moments for me in putting the show together was researching all of the, it was predominantly young men of color that were killed by police in the 80s and 90s. And there's a very long list. And I did that. I researched it because the photographers were sending us so many pictures of protests of police brutality. So the exhibit is called Whose Streets Are Streets, New York City, 1980 to 2000. And it's on view at the Bronx Documentary Center through March 5th, 2017. But it's also online at whosestreets.photo. So whosestreets.photo. And there's more than 150 photographs there, and they range from anti-war demonstrations to Tompkins Square Park riots over, housing and homelessness and gentrification. There's a lot about queer activism and reproductive rights and AIDS activism and the culture wars of the 80s and 90s, and a very important set of images about race relations in New York City and white counter protests to civil rights marches. So I really hope people will go online to whostreets.photo and check out those powerful images, because many of those issues are still relevant today. And we can learn a lot from how activists were framing them and the ways they were creating spectacles for the media to photograph to get their messages out. Sorry, I know this is a long answer, but the, for example, drawing attention to environmental racism, there's some very important photographs documenting, for example, the Toxic Avengers that staged a demo at the New York City Marathon so that when the runners hit Brooklyn, all of a sudden they were burning smoke, and there's all these activists wearing masks, and it really scared the runners, but it was a protest about citing more and more toxic waste incinerators in poor neighborhoods in Brooklyn and the Bronx, and saying, we are already suffering from really high rates of asthma and other pollution-related illnesses, and we do not want any more toxic waste processing facilities in our neighborhood. And so I hope people will check it out, and activists today might learn something from the strategies that they can see displayed in the photographs.
Terrific. Thanks so much. Well, we have taken up a lot of your time. Can you just tell us what you're working on now?
Yeah, so I'm actually co-editing a book with two of my colleagues here at RIT, with Christine Cray and Hinda Mandel. And it's an interdisciplinary book. And the working title is Nasty Women and Bad Hombres: Historical Reflections on the 2016 Presidential Election.
Terrific. Well, that sounds highly relevant. Well, Thank you so, so much for talking with us today. I really appreciated hearing about the book and the exhibit, and I know our listeners will too. So take care.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Tamar, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you for discussing your book with us today, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in History. This is your host, Isabel Moore.